Hello, everyone. This is Holden Thorpe, the editor-in-chief of Science. I'm here today to talk to Tim Snyder, a prolific author who writes about politics and history. His pamphlet on tyranny has been referred to repeatedly in the last year as the Trump administration has taken various actions in the entire government, but especially for us around science. And I thought as his words get thrown around, it would be great for our listeners to hear directly from him how he feels his lessons apply to the moment we're in for American science. So, Tim Snyder, thanks for talking to me. It's great to have you here.
Very glad to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
I got a lot of people, our listeners, you know, are mostly graduate students and postdocs and people who are trying to just run their labs in the middle of all this. And a lot of them have questions about what they should be doing right now. You know, we've had the president's budget had massive cuts in to science funding. A lot of those were reversed eventually by the Congress. There were unilateral actions to try to stop from paying universities indirect costs, which are part of how research is subsidized. There were whole universities that were shut down in terms of their funding. There were many grants cut that would have done important things in areas like the social determinants of health that were since accused of being DEI. And probably the biggest things are the things that have been done to the scientific workforce, the curtailing of programs that would continue the meager progress we've been making so that people from marginalized groups who haven't always been in science had a better chance to do it. And on an even bigger scale, taking away the thing that has really made the United States the leader of the world in science, and that is welcoming people from all over the world to do science here.
Thanks for starting off with that picture. Some of that I've been thinking about, some of it's a little bit new. I want to start with the really fundamental thing, which is that if you thought about what you were going to do to destroy the United States of America, the list that you've just given would be one of the big points. You know, you would put people in front of cameras who cast doubt about the basic workings of science. You would pitch a kind of ethic whereby individuals know the truth about science and scientists do not. You would spin wild conspiracy theories that try to draw people in and away from expertise. And then you would do the things you're talking about, defund departments, defund projects. And as you say, the most important is keeping non-Americans from immigrating here to become graduate students. I would just say that in it, you're right, I talk about other things, but for me, this one is absolutely central. If you think about like a kind of campaign to undo our country, it's hard to think of a more, you know, a more central and a more fragile, a more vulnerable point than precisely do our own people engage with the world in a scientific way? And are we doing the things we need to do to make sure that we're a leader in scientific fields? The things that you're talking about specifically are not just about science. They're about whether or not we continue to exist as a country that's meaningful and as a democracy, because that's the other thing. People like the Trump administration want to do is they want to say certain kinds of tech are fine, but we don't want to understand things for their own sake, right? So, you know, maybe it's okay if certain people make a ton of money in AI or whatever, but what we don't want is methods of understanding per se. And what I mean by that is we don't want hypothesis testing. We don't want a spirit of inquiry. We don't want to challenge, right? We don't want people to think that they could be discoverers. And that's science too. You know, it's not just status, it's not just economic growth, it's not just even knowledge. It's also that spirit that you can discover new things. And I think maybe at the most fundamental level, that's what they're against, right? Like they like, you know, certain kinds of tech that will make their friends money, they like the tech that's already in American weapon systems. But in general, they don't really like science because they don't like that spirit of inquiry and that notion that you can find out something new.
We have something very important in science in the United States, which is a graduate fellowship for graduate students that the NSF funds that are awarded to the students mm-hmm. themselves. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a great honor and all that. And they've done two things to it. One is they cut the number way back, and they've also dramatically moved the emphasis from all of science, including ecology and chemistry and biology and climate, and to mainly just AI and quantum.
Yeah.
And that supports exactly what you just said.
That's so interesting, right? That's so interesting. You can't build science without being comprehensive, because you never know, even if you're only thinking about power, you never know whether the next significant political, economic, military thing is going to come out of biology or come out of chemistry, or, you know, you may think you know right now that it's about AI, but in 5 years, it's going to seem like it's somewhere else. And the other thing about that, which is sad, is like the lack of autonomy. You know, giving a bunch of NSF fellowships means that a bunch of people have autonomy. And that autonomy is also really important. You know, the notion that as you're edging up into a lab for the first time, or as you're edging into being a graduate student, a researcher, that you have some choice as to what you're doing, that you're not just a kind of, you know, you're not just one more node where the people in power know that this is the kind of work that you have to be doing if we're going to fund you. And there's a broader concern here, which I associate with the notion of STEM, which I think has kind of gone, I don't know how this sounds to scientists, but for me, like as a parent and as a humanist and as a friend of science, right? I mean, but the what I've noticed is that like STEM has become like science is there so we can solve problems, but let's not think too hard about what the problems really are. You know, let's not think too hard about the human side of any of this. Let's just kind of train all of ourselves to be technicians, and technicians are important, but there's a lot, you know, there are larger issues which kind of go beyond this STEM mindset of just kind of keeping up with problem solving. And those issues are connected to what kind of science seems to be important to us right now, right? So for me, zoology seems really important right now. Biology seems really important to me right now because of climate change and species extinction. And people come up into science with like their own freely chosen trajectories based upon what seems to be important to them in life, in addition to what the government thinks is important at that particular moment. And I guess what I'm saying is that it's sad for me to hear that that kind of freedom is being cut out as well.
It also creates that initial feeling of the idea that it's an honor to do research on behalf of the American taxpayers. Because you get this letter from the United States of America saying, you're going to be a scientist. And it kind of sets this whole concept that is a calling. And so for fewer people to have that experience, even if that was the only thing, would be just an enormous loss.
Yeah.
So our listeners have a lot of people talking to them about what they should be doing right now. A lot of universities probably telling them to, you know, not go crazy on social media and, stick to their work. And then a lot of their peers are saying, this is a serious time and we need action. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is to give those folks the resources to understand the moment that we're in and what's possible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, of course, are being referred to your 20 lessons. I don't know if you would agree with this, but in my experience, when most people talk about your 20 lessons on tyranny, they mostly talk about the first one, which is don't comply in advance. Mm-hmm. But I think all 20 are pretty interesting. And I especially think number 2 and number 5 are really important for science. So number 2 for our listeners is protect institutions. And number 5 is remember professional ethics. Which for journalists and scientists, what I always come back to is like, okay, we can do this, but do we have all the receipts before we go into battle? And I'm going to give you what I think is a canonical example of this, and we'll see if you agree. So the Annals of Internal Medicine is a really important medical journal in the U.S. The editor of it she's going to be embarrassed that I'm using this example because she's an unassuming person, but the editor is Christine Lane, who does a really great job. And they published a paper showing that there was no link between aluminum and vaccines and disease, including autism. And RFK asked them to retract it. Now, we only retract papers if the data in the figures and tables are unreliable. Christine said no, and that was the end of it. The RFK hasn't come back to her. And to me, she was doing all three of your lessons. So she wasn't complying in advance. She didn't just say, oh, okay, I'll retract the paper. She was protecting the institution of her journal and also science in general. But the most important thing was there was nothing wrong with the paper that warranted it being retracted. And so I don't know is my analysis of your lessons correct on that? And, you know, how do you think about how those three things interact?
I mean, your analysis is so good that I feel like your question was really an answer. And I feel like, you know, if I were better informed, I would be telling this great story about Dr. Lane and the Annals of Internal Medicine, which I now will do in other settings, because it is such a beautiful example. Let me just kind of draw out a couple of points that are related to these lessons. One is that we really can't do democratic politics without some anchor in convictions about what's right and wrong. So if we just think pragmatically, then, you know, we end up always normalizing. At any given second, it's always going to seem easier to comply, you know, whether in advance or when they ask you to comply, it's always going to seem easier. And the only way not to comply is to have your own sense of the normal, whether that's personal, which is the first lesson, don't obey in advance, or whether it has to do with professional ethics, which, as you've reminded me, is lesson number five. I always get the numbers confused myself. And then that relates to a second thing that I want to say, that you can resist, you resist authoritarianism by way of pluralism. And the pluralism is also of a moral kind. That is to say, as different groups of people in society, we create together different zones of morality or what we regard as being ethically normal. And that's true regardless of profession, or to use your very nice word from early in this conversation, regardless of calling. You know, inside that calling is some sense of how that calling ought to be answered. Inside the profession is some sense of what the ethic of that profession should be. And it's very important that in our actions, in our professions, in our callings, we are breathing in that moral atmosphere and breathing it back out and making it clear to others who are maybe at the edge of it that it's real. This kind of dispute, I don't know her at all, but I would suspect when Dr. Lane was handling this issue, she was thinking of it in terms of just doing the right thing, bang, 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 bang. But she's also, in behaving this way, confirming this kind of moral glow or this moral atmosphere that our institutions create, thanks to us, and setting an example for other people. And so, I mean, it's not just a nice story about morals, it's also a story about politics, because you resist authoritarianism partly by having different groups who emanate their own moral understanding of the world outwards, which, even if you're not a scientist, right, even if you're not part of that particular group, or even if, you know, if you're not in internal medicine, if you're not a physician, even if you're not in that particular group, you look at that and you say, okay, it's not normal that the regime just tells us what's right and wrong. There are zones of people with their ideas of right and wrong, which they're putting into practice every day. But that only works if we do put them into practice every day. And then the other thing which is important about this is that it's not resistance per se, right? So resistance would be the government's doing something, I'm pushing back against it. But this is not actually that. It's like incidental resistance. It's resistance that happens because you care about the thing that you're doing. And that kind of resistance, and now I'm basically giving voice to a tradition of East European dissidents that I know, but I'm sure it's in other traditions too. That kind of resistance could be the most effective, because it's not that you're going against, it's that you're going for. You're affirming something, and because you're affirming something, there ends up being a little bit of friction. Okay, going back to obeying in advance. You may run a little bit of risk if you don't obey in advance. It's possible, you know, depending on the situation. But what I want to point out, and this story shows it too, is if you comply in advance, you're also running risks. There's no risk-free position. If you comply in advance, you're also putting at risk your reputation, your career, in this case, your journal, your institution, right? I mean, without exaggerating, if this story goes the other way, that's a blow to science, right? In some way, and so there's no risk-free position. And so it's a question of which kinds of risks you want to assume. Because the fantasy of obeying in advance is, if I obey in advance, then everything's going to be okay. I'm not taking any risks. No, you are taking risks. And pivoting back to universities which obeyed in advance to Trump were taking, in my view, greater risks than the ones who didn't. The ones who fought back generally end up in a better position at the end. I'm not saying that all stories are all going to turn out beautifully, but resisting or not complying can actually turn out to be, all in all, less risky than complying, even for you, narrowly. But for the broader political and social environment, it's definitely better.
Okay, good. So it was a perfect lead into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is, and a lot of people are sitting there in their labs, you know, reading about what their universities are doing in response to everything. And there's one argument that you just made, which is that the ones who have done deals with the administration or written checks or whatever have made things worse for themselves than they would have if they hadn't done that. I think the other side would be, you know, they got a lot of people to pay. If they can't pay everybody, there's not really an institution there. And many of them who stayed out of the spotlight were able to get some achievements. I mean, the indirect cost thing is hopefully over. There were lawsuits that were done in the background that a judge ruled that's not going to happen. Trump's budget was not adopted by Congress. A lot of people are still doing their work. So when somebody's deciding whether they want to go join the group that's outside the administration building yelling at the president for complying in advance or not, how if you try to put yourself in their shoes as to how they would apply maybe more than just one of your lessons, how do you help people frame that?
I mean, ultimately, there are going to be balances here. And so I can't I can't be dispositive, and I'm not going to try to be dispositive, but I do have a few thoughts. And I just want to start with that image you left me with, which is yelling outside the president's house. Okay. Because a really important thing around these conversations, not only about science, but about universities, is the lack of freedom of speech and assembly on American campuses. The phenomenon which began with the protests in defense of Gaza. But unfortunately, and maybe you're keeping more track of this than I am, but unfortunately, most of those restrictions on freedom of speech and assembly are still present. I think that unbalances the whole conversation in a certain way. If we're the United States of America and we don't allow the freedom of speech and assembly on our college campuses, that's going to make balancing the various considerations that you've brought up, it's going to make it tilt in a certain way, I think, right? Because certain voices, like the voices of donors, are going to get heard more, and certain voices, like the voices of students, are going to be heard less. So I'm just going to issue a plea for, which I do at every occasion, for people to take seriously the issue of freedom of speech and assembly on campus, because I think that this is a slightly different discussion, but I think that whole issue of Palestine, Gaza, Israel was used completely cynically to enforce proto-authoritarian circumstances on American campuses. And that's now been normalized, and it really has to be undone so that students can talk about science or whatever they feel like talking about. And because I think just as a formal matter, that is a necessary element for the kinds of balancing of values that you're asking me about. So that's my first point. Like, there should be more kids yelling in front of more presidents' houses. And it's a problem for the country No matter what they're yelling, you know, more science, less science. It's a problem for us that there's not as much of that as there ought to be. I think universities should be taking responsibility for that. Like the whole notion that, oh, I can't have assembly because the students will come out and talk about Gaza. I'm afraid that's out of date. There are a lot of things that students need to be talking about because there are a lot of things we all need to be talking about. And the students can help us with that. Okay, that's the first point. Second point is, and you've already made it, or at least implied it, the situation you're describing is one in which certain universities did go on the offensive, and they filed lawsuits and they won. And then certain other universities can take shelter, right, as a result of that. But what if nobody went on the offensive? If nobody went on the offensive, then the conformism, you know, or the defensive postures would have been hugely costly, right? So there's a free rider issue here, and that's okay, so long as enough people go on the offensive that you can win. And it's the offensive which is crucial here, because if you just let Trump sue you, I mean, I realize I'm simplifying this, but if you just let him sue you and you don't sue him back, if you don't realize that you can embarrass them and maybe even put costs on them with your lawsuits, then you're contributing to an artificial environment where they just think, you know, they can win all the time. And so like that would go to other lessons in the book, not just defend institutions, but also stand out. Like you have to be a little bit unpredictable in these things. You can't just wait to see what they do and then adjust. You have to also leap out and get them from the side and get them to think about whether or not what they're doing is wise. So I'm going to accept the premise of the question, which is that there can be tension between some of these lessons. And I'm just going to like give these remarks that it's better in that situation where there are competing values, it's best to hear from all voices. And also somebody has to go on the offensive. Somebody has to stand out. And if what happened is that your institution was sheltered by others who stood out, I think it's pretty important to acknowledge that rather than to say we were okay because we kept our heads down, because that's not what happened. You're not okay because you kept your heads down. You're okay because somebody else stuck their head out.
Great. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. So, you know, we were talking earlier about the professional ethics and how important it is to have like all our ducks in a row when we go on the offensive. Mm. But the people who are attacking us aren't really being held to that same standard. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when I talk about this, people will say, well, you're drawing a false equivalence. Because you're saying we have to have these high standards, but the people who are attacking us don't. And how do we go through thinking about that?
A couple things. The first is, yes, it's an unfair position, and it's part of authoritarian transitions that you're going to be in this position. It just is the way that it is. You can't win by imitating them. You either have to, as you say, keep all of your ducks in a row, or you have to think of ways to make lateral attacks and do things to them that they weren't expecting that you were going to do, and get them off balance. What you can't do is engage them exactly the way that they're engaging you, because they have their tool set is different than your tool set. So there just is an inbuilt inequality. But the second thing that I was going to say is that it's worthwhile keeping records on the people who are causing you trouble if you think that what they are doing is not just improper, but illegal, because there's quite a good chance that the rule of law is going to return to our country. And I think it's important that those who are pushing the law, bending the law, and perhaps breaking the law from within the government are aware that there are other historical possibilities aside from there just being ever more arbitrary forever. And those historical possibilities include that they're going to lose elections big, and that there will be investigations, and that perhaps in the meantime, if only for very pragmatic reasons of self-preservation, they might want to follow the law. So as we're keeping our ducks in a row, you know, it sometimes makes sense also to keep their ducks in a row, i.e. to keep records, thinking about the fact that the way they're behaving, because I think more and more of them are starting to think in this way.
So, okay, let's put these two things together now. I'm in my lab doing my thing. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about all the changes. I'm worried about my people. But we got enough money to keep going. We're doing excellent, excellent work. People are trying to stop us. Is that enough, or am I supposed to be doing something else in this environment? There's a lot of argument in our world about this right now, about what responsibilities of scientists are in this environment beyond just doing our science at the very highest level. So what advice do you have for people who are thinking through that?
That's a great question. And of course, there's no one size fits all answer, and different folks are in different positions, including in science. You know, people have different, they have tenure, they don't have tenure, they're citizens, they're not citizens, and all this stuff has to be taken into account. And people are also temperamentally different, and you can't expect everyone's going to react politically in the same way. So taking that all into account, I would say that there are three things that occur to me to think about. One is doing something that scientists aren't usually good at, forgive me, which is, explain the significance of your own work. I mean, you can jump in and tell me I'm wrong.
But no, we're demonstrably bad at it. I could give you all kinds of statistics.
Good. Yeah. The rest of us could really use that. Like, a truth-telling about the significance of past and ongoing scientific work. The rest of us could use that, because what happens is that scientists get put in the box with, like, other, you know, pointy-headed elites that you can't trust. And not that, you know, that's fair to anybody, but we can only tell stories about our own work. So I tell stories about how important history is because I believe it, right? Only scientists can tell the story about science. And we need you to do that. We need you to tell us how great and important all of this stuff is, because it helps us, it helps the rest of us to link to you as part of a bigger coalition. And also it helps to remind us that not everything is bad, that like good things could be happening, right? That there are good things on the way in so many realms. And those things are being hindered, but they could be coming, right? We need that sort of energy. But also just the way it works politically is that if you can talk about your own achievements, that's sometimes more effective than directly opposing individual policies, because people make up their own minds, and they make up their own minds sometimes based, you know, based upon specific stories that they hear, as opposed to on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, as they see it on TV. So that's one thing, is like, talking about your work and how important it is. And that's not directly, I mean, who can say that that's like objectionably political? It's not, but it has a good political effect. A second thing, which I think is really important here, is thinking about taking part in politics as a person and not a scientist. So when I have these conversations with, let's say, scientists, but I also have them with lawyers and with business people and so on, one of the things and you know, we talked about professional ethics, and that's good and that's important. But one of the things I'm interested in is, are you doing some kind of activism in your community, right? Are you involved? Are you going to protests, you know, as a person? Like, are you involved in your local Indivisible chapter or whatever as a person? Have you volunteered in your precinct as a member of your political party? Like, if you're doing something not as a scientist, but as a citizen or as a human, I think it releases some of the tension around this question, because it releases some of the dilemmas of, am I helping my lab or am I hurting my lab? And turns it more into, okay, I'm a person, I'm already doing something. And sometimes then the loop closes a different way, and it becomes not, what can I do as a scientist for everybody else? But then the question becomes, okay, now that I'm doing stuff with everybody else, how does that help me think about the science? Or how does that help me think about these political questions around the science now that I'm already engaged in doing other stuff? So the second thing is, like, do stuff that's not at all related directly to science, you know, that's local, that's day by day, that's really small scale, because that can help to repose the question. And the third thing I'm going to say is, and it relates to the university business, there have to be some troublemakers. Okay, you don't all have to be troublemakers, but there have got to be some troublemakers. There have to be some of you scientists who are just way out of the box. And, you know, you can have a meeting and decide who that's going to be or whatever, right? But there have to be some of you who are way out of the box, who are shifting where the center of the conversation is. There have to be some of you who are, like, publicly fierce and risk-taking and changing the terms of the conversation and trying to get the government on the back foot. Now, that can't be everybody. I'm not saying it should be everybody. What I am saying, a little bit like with the universities, is that it has to be somebody. There have to be some of you out there who are just saying, okay, I'm going to take this heat. This is going to be my job this time around. I'm going to be out there, and I'm going to say all the things that I know a lot of people think, and I'm going to take some of the consequences for it. And then in return, when you do have those troublemakers, you have to give them the quiet love and the support, you know, and the solidarity and so on.
It doesn't have to be everybody, I think, is an important thing that you said. On the other hand, we should certainly be celebrating the people who are willing to do it.
Yeah.
Is that a fair take?
I mean, I would say, please, everybody do something. Everybody should be, there are very few of us who can't do anything. And I'm going to suggest that folks who are in PhD programs and are postdocs or working lab scientists or scientific journalists, that is already a set of people where you can all do something, some little thing. So I think everyone should do some little thing, but the people who are doing a lot, we should try to have their back. Yeah.
Yeah. Amen to that. All right. So last question. I've heard you say, we need action and we need a vision for the future. So we've talked about a lot of action, but what's the vision for the future? Let's end this someplace we can go.
That, I think, is the essential question, because the authoritarianism that we're in now, whether it's the Trump style or whether it's the Putin style, these guys are all about suppressing the future. This is one of the things they have in common. They want to keep us in a kind of eternal present where we are fighting in us and them politics all the time, where we are sucked into, you know, more or less meaningless disputes with one another, and we're constantly in the present about who's right, who's wrong. And then they tone that with nostalgia. So, you know, Putin for the 9th century, which is a long story, which I won't go into, Trump saying, make America great again. They give us this mythical vision of a time which never happened, of course. So they can set us up for this notion that everything was good until those other people came in. And now let's get into that politics of us and them. And so the result of that kind of politics, where it's all grappling in the present and nostalgia for the past, is that there is no future, right? The future gets consumed. And to have democratic politics or to have free politics, there have to be competing visions of the future at the level of political parties, but more importantly, at the level of individuals. And so I think it's very important to recognize that a lot of the preconditions for a much better country and a much better future are, in fact, here. We have a lot of the scientific and technological preconditions for a much better country. In our storehouse of political ideas, in our traditions, we have notions that are much better than the ones that are being applied now. And that's not just, I mean, that, I think that's objectively true insofar as the statement of the future can be objectively true, but I think it's subjectively important because insofar as we're just pushing back, we will always lose because pushing back is tiring. Insofar as you're pushing back because you're also pushing forward, because you have an idea of where you want to be, you can keep at it for much longer. Pragmatically, but also psychologically, socially, it's very important to resist in the name of something. So we can tell we'll be winning when the cracks start to open and we start to see the future again. But part of resistance is working all the time to like find those cracks, to make those cracks, to talk about what we think a better future is going to be like. So that's, I mean, we've been talking about my book on tyranny, which is basically a resistance pamphlet. There's a much bigger book called On Freedom, which is about it's about my notion of freedom as positive, and it's about precisely this thing. It's about how America could be a much, much, much better country than we are right now. And the much, much is very important. I mean, partly because I think it's true, but also partly because I don't think we get over this by saying, you know what, things could be 5% better, or, you know, we could get back to 2020 or 2016 or 2012 or 2008. We can't get back to those places, and there were deep problems with those moments, and part of where we are doesn't have just to do with Trump, but with the deeper problems that were already present in those moments. So I think in order to be, like, I think it's true that there could be a much, much better future. I also think in order to be effective, we have to be thinking about that much better future and not just saying, okay, we'll win an election or two, we'll do some hedging and some compromising.
Wonderful. Well, Tim, thanks so much for talking with me. It will mean so much to our folks to be able to hear a lot of this stuff straight from you, and appreciate all you're doing for the world.
Thank you. That's really kind, and it's very elegant. And I'm sorry, I'm going to break it up by adding one more thought, which is that scientists in particular have something to say about how the future could be much better than the present. We need you for that, right? You guys have the examples and you can tell us how close we are to certain things. So the business we were talking about before, about how scientists need to talk about how important their work is in a public way, that also connects to the future. There's a way that scientists can talk about the future. You can add a dimension to talk about the future. A lot of the notion that there can be a better future does hinge on science. And part of the way the future has collapsed has had to do with, you know, everything we've been talking about, compartmentalizing, professionalizing, making everything technocratic, you know, the government deciding who gets what kinds of grants, right? It's all part of one process. Whereas you can still tell us how science is an adventure. We can solve big problems. Like, we can address species extinction. We can address climate change. We can even address wealth inequality. There are all kinds of things we can address with science. We can do it. That's a part of the story about the future, which other people can't tell. And, you know, so that goes to a lot of your questions. It goes to the question of what scientists can do as well, as help us with that sense of the future. We have this edifice of knowledge and this incredible collection of human beings, and their labor can provide important bulwarks of what could be a much better future. I mean, that's something that I think we all need to hear.
That's a perfect place to end. Thank you, Tim, so much.
Yeah, very, very glad. Thank you for reaching out. So glad we had this conversation.